Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. Look, we'll soon have another video podcast ready to upload to my YouTube channel, as well as, of course, here on audio. I'm going to keep it as a surprise who the guest is, but I know you'll enjoy it. And if you subscribe either on my YouTube channel or here at Lunch with Leon through wherever you get your podcast, you won't ever miss an edition, either whether it's on the video or here on audio. So last episode, it was trains, but I'm expecting some serious reaction to this new one today. I'm welcoming the journalist, author and podcaster Laura Laker as she makes the case for cycling. So I started out by asking her how she got into it.
So I got into cycling as an adult, and I was at the University in London in at Westminster Uni in New Cavendish Street, right by the BT Tower. And at the time, I wasn't cycling as an adult. I brought a bike with me to London from Somerset that someone had given me, and I noticed that a friend was coming into uni having cycled, and she looked very happy and very pleased with herself, including, I have to add, when it was raining. So I remember coming in and looking at Sylvia and sort of doing a double take, and she's glistening with rain, and she just looked like she'd had the best journey in. And I thought, hang on a second. And we lived quite close to each other. And so she said, I asked her about it. She said, yeah, come in, you know, I'll ride in with you one day. I'll show you the nice route. And so sure enough, we did. So my bicycle had been stolen, and which was a blessing in disguise, because it used to make my trousers very oily. And I got this wonderful brand new hybrid bike in a delightful blue colour. So I was whizzing around town on this bike and following my friend Sylvia. And we'd go through Regent's Park. And there's a lovely place near Parkway, I think it was, that would roast coffee in the mornings. And you just get these delightful smells and the weather and the sun and the fresh air. And I turn up to university just feeling brilliant and quite pleased with myself, like my friend Sylvia. And that was me hooked, really. Yeah, and I befriended someone at the bike shop, and we ended up going touring across Europe on my hybrid blue bike. And and that was me. And then I did an internship after my journalism qualification at the London Cycling Campaign. I was going to be a kind of nutrition journalist because that was my degree. And then I realised how powerful cycling could be for cities and giving people choices, making the streets a nicer place to be, and health and environment and all of this. And I just thought, what a positive thing. This is fun. It's healthy. It's good for people. It's, you know, it's just all positive. So I thought, this is me now. This is all I want to write about. So I'd write these silly blogs about me riding around London and having minor mishaps and make it all into a kind of a big game, really. And it just seemed like London was my playground. It's fantastic.
Amazing. Well, look, it is said, quite rightly, that the cycling lobby has done incredibly well, because it's come from nowhere to somewhere. I mean, to persuade the mayors of cities like London and others to give up a whole load of road space and physically segregate it for cyclists, as well as widening the footway and so on, is pretty remarkable, isn't it?
I think cycling kind of makes its own case, really. I think there has had to be a certain amount of persuasion, because you'll know this from working in buses, that the status quo is very strong, and we have a status quo bias as kind of human beings. We see what exists around us and we think, well, that's the way things need to be. And someone starts to talk about changing this with, you know, bus priority routes. People don't like change and they don't want it to change. And whether it's good, it kind of doesn't matter. You know, what the evidence says doesn't really matter. And so you need people to be pushing. And we know the data cycling. We know that a cycle lane can carry five times the amount of people. And you've talked about people and not vehicles. And if you're looking to do that, then a cycle route is far more efficient than a car route. And then there's health. You know, in the UK, we're suffering with terrible health. This is something I learned in my degree. If you can incorporate activity into people's lives, they can, you know, empower themselves to be healthy. And it doesn't take much, especially if you're not exercising, to do a little bit, you know, a little bit of walking to the bus, walking to the train, walking to the shops. That can make a massive difference to people's lives. And we're seeing the benefits of this around the world. We're seeing people are, you know, using these routes, and traffic levels are decreasing, and they're kind of doing what the evidence said they would do. And that's good for buses and trains, as well as for people cycling. And, you know, I think it's important to say it's not for cyclists, that people are campaigning for this stuff. It's for people who aren't cycling already. You know, I'd count myself among the fit and the brave, really. I would cycle through London in 2007 when there was really very little infrastructure because I loved it and I was quite, you know, assertive on the road. And I sort of had grown up driving, so well, you know, from 17. And so I sort of behaved like I was in a car, and I thought, this is my right. So, and but I know lots of people don't have that. Yeah, and so, you know, as time's gone on and more routes have been incorporated, you start to see different people cycling, and they're not, in inverted commas, cyclists. They're sort of regular people. You know, now there's all the electric bikes in London. You're seeing a much younger, much more diverse demographic, and it really is starting to be something that's for everyone. And yeah, it's very much not a kind of thing for cyclists, I would say. There's been an analysis of you know, journey length and destinations and you know, where people are travelling from and to around England. And actually, one of the greatest potentials for cycling is among children, and that's sort of up to 50, 48% of all school trips could be done by bike if there were safe routes. And you know, imagine the power of that. We know the school run is one of the greatest contributors, single contributors to sort of congestion on the roads. And we know that during holiday times, summer holidays, Easter holidays, the roads are much quieter, certainly in London anyway, perhaps not everywhere. And so, yeah, if you can have children able to cycle that on their own to school from age 11, like they are in the Netherlands, then those parents don't have to be ferrying their children backwards and forwards. And that's better for everyone. You know, it's better for bus journey times, it's better for congestion, air pollution, all of that. And it's, you know, and it's a nice healthy way of traveling, and it gives kids independence. So I think people who are, certainly for me, this is a future that I would like to see. And like you, I work in this field because I believe in you know, transport choice and enabling people to travel in a healthy and affordable way. And you know, cycling and walking are such fantastic ways of doing that.
Indeed. Well, look, as you know, you're talking at least partially to the converted here, because if I don't do my 10K a day walking, it's a bad day. It's harder to do in the winter, but it's a bit easier to do, of course, in the summer. And I was just reflecting before coming to talk to you. I used to think Ride London, the Saturday of Ride London, where the streets were closed and it was a free for all for anybody who wanted to cycle around the centre of London, was such a great event. And in particular, the smiles on the faces of the children and what were clearly clusters of people who'd come together that day in order to, if you like, cycle through some of the heaviest trafficked streets in London that were empty of traffic and go past some of the famous monuments and memorials and buildings and so on as well. And it was delightful.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It was such a wonderful event, and it really showcases, and this is what we saw during the pandemic as well, when you reduce traffic from the roads, general traffic, then people, you realize, one, how much space there is on in the street that we dedicate to sort of private vehicles, but then also, you know, how much unmet demand there is just for people to get out on their bikes, to enjoy themselves, to explore the city. And then an extension of that, of course, is being able to get from A to B. But ultimately, you know, what got me back into cycling, and I think one of the things that I still love about it all these years later, I've been writing about this for 15 odd years now, is the joy that it brings. I mean, I cycled into town this morning, beautiful weather. It's just, you know, it's one of the best parts of the day. And for kids particularly, and that freedom and that health and that confidence that it gives them, you really can't, you know, put a price on that. I think it's wonderful.
No, indeed. And frankly, of course, and some of the improvements that we made, we had to make for safety reasons. And there's no doubt that where cyclists are adequately segregated, that gives people much more confidence. So for people like me, who's, you know, old and not desperately confident, the segregated cycleways, the cycle superhighways in London, do such a brilliant job because we don't feel under threat anymore. And I think that has been tremendous. Some brave political decisions, because you know this is a democracy, and we were under pain of death, of course, from Boris that we had to get the cycle superhighway network done before he came out of power in May 2016, which we did just about. This is a tough political thing for the elected representatives to get through, bearing in mind both their desire to do good things and stay in power.
Yeah, it is tough, and it does take a brave person. And you know, Boris Johnson, you know, whatever you think of his politics, was one of those people. And Sadiq Khan his his successor has done similarly, bold work in improving the cycleways in London and reallocating road space. And it is difficult, and people don't like change, and people will resist change. And there are very strongly motivated people who will, shout quite loud about change and about how they don't want it. And they can give the impression that most people are against this. And we see this also with energy saving measures and things like wind farms. Most people support green measures and improving energy efficiency, and most people support cycling actually and would like to see cycling. I think where it gets difficult is where you're actually talking about, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to have to change the way that the streets work, and we're going to have to reallocate some road space. And that's where the conversation gets difficult, I think. But there's quite an interesting and quite a fun theory called the, I mean, it's not fun if you're kind of the receiving end of it, but called the Hill of Hysteria. So at the beginning, when something proposed, say a main road cycleway or a low traffic neighborhood, people might generally think, well, okay, I don't want lots of people driving through my neighborhood. Wouldn't it be nice if my children could play out? Wouldn't it be nice if elderly people could cross the road? And maybe I could use it as well. Maybe I could cycle too, or walk more. But then the reality kind of hits, and then you get this kind of hill. It looks like a bit of a bell curve, and then people will get very angry and worried and start sort of shouting and saying, "Well, what if? What about?" But then, as the scheme beds in, once it's been implemented, and you'll have seen this with bus lanes as well, priority bus lanes, dedicated bus lanes, people sort of calm down. They see what's happened. They see actually there are benefits to this as well as perhaps behavior changes that I might need to make or my family might need to make. And overall, lo and behold, the changes turn out to be better, because having lots of cars on the street dominating the urban realm isn't actually good for anyone. It's not good for if you drive, and it's not good if you walk or cycle, take the bus. And actually, if we can sort of modify those journeys and tweak people's behaviors a little bit and just encourage them not to drive for those short journeys, then you free up the road space for people who do need to use their car.
The reason why I'm smiling, Laura, of course, is that fairly recently I was just debating the first brave move really that Ken Livingstone made in London was the pedestrianisation of the north side of Trafalgar Square, which was
Yes.
just radical at the time. How could you possibly get rid of the traffic on the north side of Trafalgar Square, surrounded by people who said it would be a complete disaster? Now, I mean, it's a very important piece of urban realm, and nobody in their right mind would undo that now.
Wonderful.
And in fact, it's quite a small scale scheme
Exactly.
by comparison, but of course, it's beautiful. And that whole
In
area,
hindsight,
yeah, that whole,
yeah.
and that is a perfect example of what you described, which is there was a huge amount of opposition to it, but in due course, people thought this is rather nice and would never go back to how it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's normal. Yeah, it's not, this is a normal part of it, but it is very scary for politicians if they're faced with this kind of backlash and they're frightened that they might get voted out or they might be wrong. But
Indeed.
actually, it's generally proven that they're right.
Indeed. So look, I've got a whole load of listeners will never forgive me if I don't blame you for two things. One is the terrible worsening of
Personally.
yes, you personally, but not just you personally, but the cyclists as a whole. Firstly, the terrible worsening of bus speeds in London, which is directly leading to a reduction in the number of passengers, and they attribute the worst traffic speeds to how much road space has been taken away and devoted to pedestrians as well as to cyclists. And the other thing they wouldn't forgive me for not raising with you is that there are some cyclists who take some liberties with the highway code, are there not?
Okay, so two things. So the first thing, bus times and cycleways. Now, obviously, cycleways have increased in length in London over recent years, but they actually take up a very small proportion of London's roads by mileage. There's an enormous amount of roads in London. Actually, very, very, very few of them have a cycle lane, and I haven't seen any. I don't know if you've seen, but I haven't seen any evidence that the two are linked. And actually, bus speeds, as far as I've seen, have remained relatively steady since 2013-14. The one time bus speeds increased, as in, buses got faster, was during the pandemic, when guess what was off the roads? Motor
Yes,
cars.
no, indeed.
And we talked earlier about the most efficient way of moving people on the roads. And if a cycleway can move five times more people than a road lane, then you're looking to move as many people, including on buses. then pointing at cyclists is not the sort of answer, clearly. And I think this is another way that we naturally look at what's exists and think, well, that must be the right way to do things. You know, cars are on the road, you're not going to change that. When actually we know that people's behavior is plastic. And when fuel prices go up, people drive less. When it gets harder to drive, people drive less. That's kind of what needs to happen. I was looking at Manchester's Oxford Road, which was, perhaps still is, the busiest bus corridor in Europe.
Yeah, sure.
And in 2015, they made it bike and bus only. They put a dedicated bike lane in. They rationalized a lot of the buses, but they made this beautiful bus corridor. And peak journey times on the Leeds to Manchester route fell by over 25%. So journeys went from 65 minutes to 50 minutes, under 50 minutes. What did they get rid of? The cars. So I think this is kind of the sort of strange things. Buses and cycles should work
Well,
together, but yeah, for
one of
some
the
reason we're sort of pit against each other when the great majority of the road space is taken up by motor vehicles.
indeed, and one of the chief culprits, funnily enough, of course, is actually white vans doing deliveries from broadly internet shopping. And it is outrageous, isn't it, that people order their Amazon books or whatever, and broadly a white van is delivering it to your Zone 1 CBD office because you're not at home to receive it. And I think we'd both agree, wouldn't we, that there's a fair chunk of unnecessary local deliveries taking place in the central areas of many of our cities.
Yeah, very much. And yeah, there's a lot of rationalization that can happen around deliveries, around waste collection. And also, you know, the taxi number of private hire vehicles in London has skyrocketed. And what do they spend all day doing? They're not like you or I. You know, if you or I were driving in London, we would start the car, drive from A to B, and then stop. No, taxis are sort of constantly circulating. And so I don't know. There's a lot of different factors. I don't know, but I think it's wrong to point at cycling. I don't think that's the cause. That's just not the cause. I haven't seen any evidence to show that that's the cause. What it is something new, and so it's easy to point at. But you know, vehicles have gotten bigger. People are driving SUVs around central London. It's very hard for drivers to get past each other. The busiest road, the most congested road in London, is the A5204, which is Wigmore Street in Westminster. No bike lane there, but lots of parked cars.
Yeah, indeed. And shortly to be
So
even busier.
what's kind of causing the solution?
Yeah, shortly to be even busier with the closure of Oxford Street, of course. Now, you nearly got away with not answering the question about cyclist behaviour.
Oh yes, about behaviour.
Yeah,
Yeah, this is
there's some
another
work to
one,
do
and I
there.
think there was some. I mean, you know, I always point to research from 2017, which looked at law breaking by cyclists and law breaking by motorists, and actually the two are very comparable. And I'm not saying either is right, but I do think we sort of scapegoat one road user. I think cyclists are more visible as a person, whereas we quite often see a driver as a vehicle, and we sort of see that vehicle as an inevitable factor on our street when it's not. As you know, it's someone choosing to drive in a certain way, and driving behavior in London can be very poor. I see people jumping red lights. You know, I see people driving across crossings. I mean, you know, when I'm cycling around, I see very, very bad behavior, lots of mobile phone use. So certainly people on bikes do behave badly, but they're not, you know, they're not by any means the only one. And I don't think it's, you know, they're not the biggest cause of harm on the streets by any means either, you know, just through sheer physics. But yeah, I think there's definitely a piece to improving people's behavior. And I think, you know, obviously crossing, when pedestrians are crossing, riding through on a bike is not acceptable, as it wouldn't be if you're driving a vehicle.
Indeed. I'm also always moved, and this is in the autonomous vehicle argument. People frequently say to me, autonomous vehicles are going to be dangerous. And I frequently say, well, they're not going to be more dangerous than humans because motor vehicle accidents kill 4 or 5 people a day now in this country. So it's hard to believe that autonomous vehicles won't be safer than we are because we're already killing 4 or 5 people a day. And isn't it interesting that
Yeah, and
your
I.
point earlier that up to 1,500 deaths directly related to motor vehicles in this country doesn't even merit a square inch in the back of the local paper. But one
There's
autonomous
no
vehicle
sense of that.
once, yeah, one autonomous vehicle once that ran out of control and hit the truck is front page news.
Well, that's the thing about journalism, and it's a bit of a paradox, really. It's the sort of dog bites man isn't a story, but man bites dog is. And so it's the unusual stories that get the headlines, and then they seem like they're sort of normal. And it's this sort of bizarre thing with news that the unusual becomes the story, and then we think that's what's happening more broadly. But yeah, it is, and I think it's important we don't call them accidents as well, because quite often it's someone's choice to, drive fast, or it's road design, or it's, inattention. And I think it's important not to, to sort of question why these collisions are happening. I did some road collision reporting guidelines a couple of years ago for media to try and get people to change the way they talked about it and talk about the driver and not just the car, because I think we do, like you said, so many deaths every year and serious 20,000 serious injuries, and these are lifelong injuries, and we don't get that sense of that bigger scale. And I do think it's important to remember and to highlight that, because it's hiding in plain sight quite often.
Sure. And if you or I ran a factory that had that level of fatalities and serious injuries, we'd be in jail immediately, wouldn't
Yeah,
we?
and that's not even counting the air pollution death, the health harms of noise pollution, and all of that. But it's amazing. We just come to accept this presence on our road. And I've got nothing against driving. I just think it's really taken over our cities and towns to a very unhelpful degree. And I think we need more choice in the transport system.
And then, of course, the other thing that's happened is various bits of innovations have filled in all the little gaps. So I'm talking about e-scooters and electric bikes and electric motorbikes. And, there's a whole range of products now that sit, whereas previously we had two-wheeled bicycles and four-wheeled motorized vehicles. We've now got lots of things all in the middle of that, many of which are not properly covered by the legislation, are they?
That's right. Yeah, and there's been a consultation from central government also talking about trying to change the language around mobility aids that people with disabilities will use. So the hand cycles that people might attach to their wheelchairs to make them kind of more like cycles, and stopping calling them invalid carriages, which is, incredibly archaic and slightly offensive language, and trying to include this new era of electric mobility, which can be really empowering for people with disabilities. And I've got an electric bike, and I whiz around London on it, sort of mix up with my regular bike, and it's wonderful. You see so many people on these on the Lime bikes as well, which is pretty great.
I remember my first e-scooter ride, which funnily enough was during UITP in Stockholm, and from memory it was in June, so like it was still light at 10:30 at night. And frankly, riding an e-scooter through Stockholm at 10:30 at night when it's not even dark is a really nice experience. You know, it was a good fun. And in fact, I arrived at a dinner on it where, unluckily for me, all my colleagues were sat in the window, so they saw me arrive on it, which was super super funny for them. But what a super experience it was. And I mean, it doesn't quite give me the health benefits because I'm not using any exercise. But on the other hand, I'm not a vehicle. I'm not in a taxi. I'm not causing pollution, and I'm not adding to any congestion.
Yeah, it's very efficient. They are quite fun. I tried them in Paris pre-pandemic, and I remember rattling along the cobbles on them. But being a great deal of fun. It's slightly alarming at first. Once you get going, it's brilliant.
Everybody I've ever told this thinks it's funny. I watched very carefully how you hire an e-scooter before I actually went and did so myself, so I didn't look like an idiot. But having hired it, I hadn't observed that you have to sort of pedal it away to get a bit of speed up before it goes. So there I was, just flicking the accelerator, hoping to go somewhere, and nothing was happening.
Humbling experience.
It is. Well, it's a great leveling experience too, of course, which is tremendous.
It
You're so active in this space that there's lots of places where people can see and hear what you're up to. So, do you just want to tell us a bit about where we can find you online and elsewhere?
So I wrote a book a couple of years ago about the National Cycle Network. It's about my adventures, some of which are on my pink e-bike around the NCN, cycling here and there, a bit of a state of the nation. I've got a website, laura-laker.com. I've got a Substack, which is Potholes and Pavements, which is the name of my book, Bumpy Ride Continues. And then there's a podcast, which I do, called Streets Ahead. And then, I write for various kind of national and cycling and transport related titles here, there and everywhere. And I'm about to write a toolkit for rural path campaigners about how they can get a path in their area, because it's very hard at the moment to get the landowner issues and then the funding together. And there's lots of amazing people trying to build these traffic-free routes in the countryside. And as a country girl, having grown up in Somerset, I feel very strongly about having the option to, not have to drive when you live somewhere rural or interurban.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, there is no doubt that the rural areas have got a very bad deal out of this, haven't they? Because car is just about the only option for many people,
Literally, yeah.
because of the topography, because of the condition of the roads, because of the lack of public transport of any reasonable sort. I mean, people in rural areas have a tricky time.
And but yeah, the distances aren't that great. I mean, I grew up sort of, I don't know, it was a 10-minute cycle to the nearest village from my little town, and I didn't realize until maybe 5 years ago that it was so easy. I'd literally always driven there, and you know, there's a main road, so you do have to be quite brave. But it's possible, and you know, these are the kind of distances. So this is something, you know, cities are obviously where the most journeys could happen, but I'm always banging the drum for rural areas as well, because I do think it's really important.
And do you also find, as I do, that for all sorts of reasons that we can imagine, out of the cities, the numbers of people with the right skills in any sort of local authority is so small that, frankly, it's very hard to get any of these things on any sort of agenda, isn't it? Because the local authorities themselves, the highway authorities, have been hollowed out.
Yeah, that's right.
They've got less money and lots to do. And to try and attempt anything radical or just even a change in thought process is actually quite hard.
Yeah, it's hard, and there's limited funds available, and the benefit cost ratios tell you that you know, the places with the biggest populations are those to get to. But I would, you know, to focus the funding on, but I would say that, you know, places with fewer options benefit disproportionately more. And Active Travel England does have some capacity to help rural authorities. There was a council officer in Devon that kind of drove the creation of the Tarka Trail and other rural routes that are now legendary, you know, famous across the UK and massive tourist draws. But he really had to fight for that. And I interviewed him for my past project. And yeah, but you really need someone who's very skilled and very, very dedicated to do that. But they are out there. And I hope that with Active Travel England and the help that they're giving authorities, that more of this can happen. Because it's not, you know, it's not hard. It's not like building a motorway or, heaven forbid, a railway. You know, it's not hard stuff. It's sort of a narrow, fairly narrow path through, you know, with just needs to be smooth and have some crossings. It really is quite easy. But yeah, it's just how we think about transport. And you know, most of our journeys are short. 70% are under 5 miles, 25% are less than 1 mile. These are very, very short journeys that we could walk or cycle, and we overlook them, I think, because it's almost too easy to do. So I think it's important that we remember those humble short journeys that really transform people's lives.
Indeed, indeed. And of course, the other one, which you've the title, of course, Potholes and Pavements, your book just reminds us about the chronically terrible state of many of our roads generally, which is not unconnected with heavier vehicles, more vehicles,
That's
lack
right.
of Russian oil to make decent tarmac, burst water mains, and constraints on public expenditure. I mean, even in a vehicle, the state of the roads is very uncomfortable, and certainly if you're on two wheels, uncomfortable to the point of even being potentially dangerous.
Being dangerous, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is a big problem. And I mean, it's a bit of a mischievous title, but I didn't want anyone to think that I've written the book on behalf of the Sustrans, now the Walk Wheel Cycle Trust. It's catchy. Got an
Very good.
alliterative name. I needed an alliterative book title.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Of course, of course. But it does remind us, doesn't it, that the state of good repair on the highway network. I mean,
Very
now,
poor.
let's put this another way. Continuous reductions in public expenditure has taken slices and slices and slices out of the highway maintenance budget,
Yeah,
and as a
it
result of
has.
which the state of the road is not very good. But it's also the climate change is in there as well, isn't it? Because some of that is also to do with the fact that the subsoil is being washed away far more often than it was in the past.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I keep reading stories about roads that have been washed away, and the count, you know, there's no hope. The current funding status of local authorities, there's no hope of reinstating these roads. And sometimes they end up just being walking and cycling roads. And there's one near where my sister lives in near Minehead, Watchet in Somerset, and it's washed away. And it really does seem like it's a goner now. And the money that's required to put it back, but it does have a big impact. And then what are those false economies? Because then people who drive end up paying with their insurance premiums because of damage to their vehicles. You know, if you're cycling and you hit one, heaven forbid, then you know you're looking at a hospital stay potentially. I've interviewed people, and it's really quite horrific. But yeah, it's one of those false economies, and then it just makes getting around even trickier.
And what advice would you give, Laura, to employers? Because some of the influence in the people's lifestyle choices comes from their employers, doesn't it? So is there a handbook, a textbook, a toolkit for employers who want to encourage more active travel?
Yeah, the Cycling UK, the national cycling charity, had a cycle-friendly employers scheme, and I'm not sure how active it is at the moment, but it was great because it kind of ranked employers based on how much they provided their employees with in terms of things like showers, safe locking spaces, lockers, places to dry things, places to store your bike securely, really make a difference to people's ability to travel actively. And I would also say that in your local area, you have a huge influence actually as an employer to improve the infrastructure for walking and cycling. And in a globalized workplace, people want to choose places where they can walk and cycle, livable neighborhoods, places where they can stroll around at night, where there's nice kind of pedestrian areas, there's nice routes to go out into the countryside by bike, or it's this stuff actually really makes a difference to people. And I think employers really could make a big difference in encouraging local authorities to be brave, to take bold decisions and implement this stuff, which actually has a massive impact on people's lives. And bringing it back to joy makes a place somewhere that people want to live and want to work and want to stay and raise a family and grow old. And it's so often overlooked, and it's so simple in a way, but it just creates this kind of magic that you really can't recreate, I don't think, with other transport modes. And it links to everything, it links to bus and rail and all of that. So yeah, the humble short journey.
Laura, that's been fabulous. Thank you very much indeed. And this has been Lunch with Leon, which is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Do go across to passengertransport.co.uk for all the latest news and information. But I've been joined today by Laura Laker, who has done such a brilliant job making the point, making the case for more cycling, for all the benefits that we've heard about, including your health, including your mental health, and including the planet. And of course, the livability of the cities in which we've learned to live in. So, Laura, thank you very much indeed for me, and we'll see you again very soon.
So much. Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Lunch with Leon, presented by Leon Daniels. It is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine, where you will find all your latest public transport news. Send in a review or a rating, whoever you get your podcasts from.